This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Members of Iraq's warring factions, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, met last month to talk about prospects for peace. But they didn't meet in Iraq. They went to Helsinki for a weekend of closed-door negotiations. The meeting was organized by my guest, Porig O'Malley. It was the second meeting of Iraqis O'Malley held in Helsinki. The participants agreed on a framework for negotiations. The next round of talks are planned for Baghdad. O'Malley is a distinguished professor of peace and reconciliation at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He grew up in Dublin and lived there during the Troubles. He worked on peace negotiations in Northern Ireland and South Africa. To demonstrate to the Iraqis that reconciliation is possible, O'Malley brought to the Helsinki meeting former enemies from Northern Ireland and former enemies from South Africa who had learned to work together in new governments. One of the South Africans who attended the Helsinki meeting is also my guest, Mac Maharaj. He was a leader of the African National Congress Underground and got to know Nelson Mandela when they were both prisoners on Robben Island. Maharaj was the first minister of transport in the post-apartheid government. O'Malley has written a book about Maharaj called Shades of Difference. Porig O'Malley, Mac Maharaj, welcome to Fresh Air. Mac Maharaj, you spent a long time as the leader of the African National Congress's underground. How much awareness do you think the people who were at this meeting of Iraqis, how much did they know about the history of the South African struggle?
I think all of them have taken interest in South Africa and Northern Ireland to one extent or another, some more deeply than the others. But when we go there and participate in their meetings as facilitators, what I saw them reacting to was that at one occasion, as Cyril Ramaphosa was chairing in his capacity as facilitator, and they had all spoken from the Iraqi side, he then came into the discussion and said, I have made the following notes of each of your concerns. And he listed them all. And he said, we will now try to address and enable you to talk around each of those issues. That inclusivity lit their eyes because he was not trying to say one group's views will prevail over another. He was saying each of these points that you have raised merit attention. And once he did that, he was articulating a principle that we had learned through our own experience.
You know, Porig O'Malley is the author of a book about you and your role in the struggle in South Africa. You were in prison for 12 years, and in the introduction to this book, which is written by Nelson Mandela, Mandela describes you as being legendary in South Africa for several things, including your ability to withstand unimaginable torture. Was it difficult for you to see the representatives of the government that was authorizing your torture? Was it possible early on in your attempts to participate in reconciliation to see them as anything but evil?
It wasn't that difficult a problem to be able to talk to the enemy who had been my torturers. And it wasn't difficult because while under torture in 1964, I learned to make a distinction in the case of a particularly brutal torturer. I learned to respect him for the way in which he conducted his torture. He was trying to understand me and trying to be one step ahead of my thinking. And I realized then, you may hate your enemy, but do not be trapped by that hatred, because then you are in danger of underestimating their capacity. You need to respect their technical skills while you hate and totally disagree with their philosophy, their political outlook, and their political program.
What was the most difficult aspect for you of working with the people who had been your enemy in a power-sharing government? And what was the most difficult thing about that that you wanted to communicate to the Iraqis?
The most difficult one was to get within the power-sharing arrangement an agreement on reconciliation and reconstruction that addressed the inequalities and the inheritance of that oppressive system of apartheid. Because there was a tendency for the white minority in South Africa and the party that represented them to merely say, forget the past, let's reconcile and shake hands and move forward without appreciating how much injury we had done to each other. So when the Iraqis listen to that experience, they begin to say, yes, we have deep wounds amongst ourselves as Iraqis, but we need to be able to deal with our differences within a political framework and a set of principles which do not require us to resort to violence and war with each other.
Porug O'Malley, did you ask the Bush administration for its blessing on this peace initiative that you've launched?
No. We never consulted anybody, but we allowed them through intermediaries to know what we were doing.
Terry, there are many initiatives going on around Iraq. This initiative in which we are involved is an independent and separate one, and its focus is merely to get the Iraqis together to put their own vision, which includes living amongst themselves with their differences but without resorting to violence. That way, they have a common national vision in which they can interact with the rest of the world, knowing what their national interests require. All other initiatives have the tendency to wrap in both external interests and the interests of Iraqis into one process. And I believe that what we are trying to do would be of interest to all external parties because it provides them with a basis to understand what Iraqis want for themselves.
So, Porug O'Malley, part of your job was organizing the conference, choosing the people from Iraq who would participate, convincing them to come. So you went to Iraq, and I understand you had like $40,000 in your pocket for travel money so that you could buy the airline tickets for the people who are going to be participating in the conference. I guess my first question is, it seems like it would be mighty unsafe to be in Iraq, which is already unsafe, and have $40,000 in your pocket.
Iraq is a cash economy. It's not a credit card economy. So if you have to purchase something, you have to purchase it with cash. But for the last year, that is since last June, I have spent 2 weeks of every month in Iraq, except for October, putting these conferences together and going to them to invite them to something is far more, it is different, Terry. They will say to me repeatedly, we've been invited to many conferences, but nobody has come here and actually asked us. We might get an email, we might get a telephone call, or we might get it through an agency, but you people are the first who have come to ask us. That establishes bonds between us.
Porug O'Malley, since you've been spending 2 weeks out of nearly every month for the past year in Iraq trying to organize the conflict resolution meeting, the conflict has become more personal for you because your life has been endangered by it. Through living in Iraq, did you find it difficult to not start taking sides?
Well, I lived in Northern Ireland and I'm Irish and learned not to take sides. So it is a lot easier not to take sides in Iraq. Every side in Iraq has grievances, and conflict is about dealing with people's accumulated grievances. And I am able to empathize by listening.
When people saw you as an American, and I know...
No. I carry an Irish passport.
You carry an Irish passport.
I identify myself at all times as being Irish. And
does that help?
It sure does. It sure does.
How does that help?
One has to say, and I can say this unequivocally, that all Iraqis that I have met, and I've met Iraqis at every level, resent what is called the occupation. And they resent that Americans are treated differently at checkpoints, that even the most senior, even ministers of government, have to go through checkpoints in Iraq. Americans, low-level employees of the State Department, do not.
And what about you?
There are me. When I'm in Iraq, I'm a prisoner. literally a prisoner. I can only move from place to place if I'm with somebody carrying the necessary identification to move me to that place. So Iraq is within the green zone, it's entirely segregated according to the color of the card you carry, because that card identifies your position. I can leave my hotel to go to the first checkpoint, but as soon as I get to the first checkpoint, I am not allowed through if I'm not accompanied by somebody who has the authority to take me through. And a funny example of that was that I was trying to meet with some members of the United Nations, but the people I was meeting with only had authority to get to a certain checkpoint. I had the authority to walk to that checkpoint, but not to go through it. So, in fact, if we wanted to talk to each other, we had to use bullhorns to talk over the checkpoint. So a whole day can go by, if you have a meeting, even within the green zone, of hours going through checkpoints, and then you get to meet the person, then the electricity goes out, then the internet goes down, and I have spent a lot of time in the Iraqi parliament, and nothing works there. I mean, the lights go out, internet works every other day. People have to leave work early because of fighting in such places, a sadder city, so the average work day might be at best 5 hours.
Is this one of the reasons why you hold the meetings in Finland and not in Iraq?
Yes. In fact, one of the comments I think made to Mac when he was leaving by Minister Al-Hakim, who's the Minister of Dialogue and National Reconciliation, was that he didn't think they would have the capacity to hold a conference of the type we had just had in Finland in Iraq. The lack of skills at every level is that nothing gets done. After I had sent invitations by email 3 times to participants in Iraq, because of having been there so often, I kind of took the position that they probably didn't get the emails. So I had to go there to verify whether or not they got the invitations. Nobody had received an invitation. So when the Iraqis are asked to meet benchmarks, what's not taken into consideration is whether or not they have the internal administrative capacity to do so, whether they have the structure to do so. I mean, the telephone system, Arakna, the national telephone system, doesn't work.
Mac Maharaj, for many years you were head of the African National Congress's underground, and the ANC was an armed militant group in the apartheid era. Because of that, do you feel a kind of understanding of why some Iraqi groups are armed groups now, having come from an armed group yourself?
Yes, I think so, because I've come to the position that people take to arms for a reason. Something pushes them to it. And if we want them to lay down their arms, it cannot be by a unilateral imposition or by crushing them. We have to lay a basis to say, what is your political problem? Here is a forum. Come and talk. And unless we do that, we will only treat the problem at its symptom level rather than at its root causes. So, to put it very sharply and extremely, I come from a background that says that in humankind's march to freedom, people have a right to revolt against tyranny. And once you acknowledge that right, you create the basis for enemies to sit at the table. At some stage in every conflict, armed conflict, there will have to be negotiations, even if it is between a victor signing a truce with the vanquished. But there will be negotiations.
Mac, I know you have to leave our conversation because you need to go and teach a class now. Thank you very much for participating in the conversation. Porik, not that I want to end on a discouraging note, but after the IRA put down its arms, you wrote an op-ed basically saying, you know, great, the IRA puts down its arms and then along comes the jihadis. Is it very discouraging for you to know that, you know, in all likelihood, one conflict is resolved and another one comes along. One fanatical group, and you describe the IRA as fanatical, puts down its arms, and another fanatical group picks up theirs or picks up, you know, more stronger weapons.
No, I see that in the nature of things, Terry. It took 40 years of effort to bring the Northern Ireland conflict to what I wouldn't call an end, but to a settlement that must be nurtured over the years in order for it to work. But there is a way of reaching people who are in militant organizations, and there is a way of drawing them slowly into a process. You cannot do it by the manner in which the Sadrists are being told to lay down their arms or the Mahi army in Baghdad by conducting guerrilla warfare, targeting people from 70,000 feet. I mean, this is just doubling and tripling the support for the militias. They must be talked to. They must be brought into the process. And in the end, if we are honest about it, someplace, someday, someone will have to make contact with Al-Qaeda and say, we have come to talk.
Of course, the people with arms have to be ready to talk, too. There was going to be a representative from Muqtada al-Sadr's group, but he never made it to the Helsinki conference in April. And he said that there was a problem with the plane, but, you know, I'm skeptical by nature, so I figure who knows if that was really the problem.
No, it wasn't a problem. Wasn't a problem with the plane. I talked to him on the Thursday morning at 11 o'clock. And the plane was due to leave Baghdad at 3. And he said that he was caught in Sadr City, that he couldn't get out. There was fighting going on, and he wasn't able to make it out. Now, that same person attended Helsinki 1 and signed off to the principles of Helsinki 1. I will go back to him and be talking to him within the next month, and I would be asking him to find ways that I can make contact with people that are in fact closer to al-Sadr with the view to bringing the message that there is a table, that they are welcome at the table, and there are no preconditions.
One more question. You've been going to Iraq about 2 weeks out of every month to help organize these conflict resolution meetings that you've been holding in Helsinki. It's really hard from everything I've heard to go in and out of Iraq and to, you know, adjust to the safety of the United States and then go back and expose yourself to the dysfunction and the dangers of Iraq. Is this wreaking havoc with you psychologically and emotionally to be going back and forth on such a regular basis?
Yes, it is definitely having an impact, a larger one than I thought. Iraq, at least in the Green Zone, is a place of, to me, of spiritual despair, where the stories you hear from people of what they have gone through and are going through and the inability of the government to deliver on basic services is heartbreaking. And then to contrast that with the way in which many ministers and government officials live within the Green Zone in conditions of maximum security, but they live in isolation from the people. And the American presence, occupation, whatever you wish to call it, is a large part of the problem. But it is also recognized at this point that a precipitous withdrawal would probably result in a civil war. And I think this is something that should be asked of presidential candidates when they are formulating policies regarding the withdrawal of American troops. Are they ever saying to themselves, what is good for the Iraqis? What responsibilities do we have to them? Must we not first ask them, what do you want us to do? What should we do to leave?
I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and be safe on your travels. Thank you.
Thank you.
Purug O'Malley is a professor of peace and reconciliation at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He hopes to hold the next round of Iraq peace talks in Baghdad. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, a nobody who came from a line of nobodies in a conservative Catholic country that feared sexuality, is how Nuala O'Fuilon once described herself. In her best-selling memoir, Are You Somebody?, she wrote about growing up in poverty in a family of 9 children in Ireland. She'd been a columnist for the Irish Times, who became well-known in England and America through her memoirs and novel. O'Fuilon died of lung cancer Friday night at the age of 68. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded with her in 2001 after the publication of her novel, My Dream of You. It's the story of a middle-aged Irish woman who escaped the conditions of Ireland years ago by emigrating to England, where she writes for a travel magazine. After the death of her best friend, she has a midlife crisis, quits her job, and returns to Ireland to research an obscure 19th-century divorce scandal known as the Talbot case. It helps her understand her country's sexual repression and misogyny, as well as her own malaise. Here's a brief reading.
I was interested always in any story about passion. I believed in passion the way other people believed in God. Everything fell into place around it. Even before I started mooching around after boys, when I was 14, I'd understood, watching my mother, that passion was the name of the thing she was pursuing as she trawled through novel after novel.
Now, your character believes in passion. She's also middle-aged, and a lot of people assume that passion is supposed to burn less hot in middle age. Do you believe that, the nature of passion changes?
Oh, yes, of course. Where it sits in your heart and your mind change. Because simply, how can it still be appropriate at, say, 54 to be running after the dream that you ran after when you were 14? How can you go on believing, and yet one does, how can you go on believing that somewhere in the world there's the other, the perfect person, the one who will understand you and cherish you, and you will be as good back? How can you believe that that'll happen and it'll solve everything when, for one thing, when you're middle-aged, you have a history that you can never share? No matter how hard you try, it isn't there to be given. You can never describe it. And so you're already late to the table of perfect passion.
That's an interesting way of putting it. How does that apply to you as someone who's middle-aged?
Well, what I resent now is that I can't get rid of it. I can't get rid of the hope of something wonderful happening. And even at this late stage, having somebody who worries about me because I have to go to the dentist, or who wants to talk to me about our plans for the summer holidays. I would like to forget all that. And I'd like to forget how much my body would like to have had more use. I would like to be rid of all that, because I feel demeaned a bit by still secretly longing for it. I'm getting better and better as I get older at all the other things, which is the great discovery of middle age. I never knew till a few years ago what animals can do. I had never had a dog or a cat before, and I hadn't realised that's a whole new kind of joy. And I hadn't realised either that you can make new friends in middle age. And I hadn't realised that you feel terribly well. I feel terrifically healthy, mentally and physically. So all kinds of things are kicking in. And if only I could stop wanting the impossible, I'd be as happy as a lark, Derek.
Now the
and you see, who planted the seed of that impossible dream? It makes sense when you're young and you're looking for someone to mate with and build a nest with. But by my age, we have our nests and there won't be any children. So why is it just as... why does it pick at you and pull at you just as badly?
Well, what do you think? Do you think it's because it's a natural thing to yearn for that, or do you think it's the influence of novels and movies and fantasies?
I think it's cultural. I mean, for most of human history, and I think on most parts of the planet, there hasn't been this primacy of romantic love. But after all, I belong to my culture and I've been soaked in it since I can remember. And you know, the thing is this. The reason why there's a huge romance industry of songs and movies and dressing to attract and all that is because, on the whole, most people's lives are not very celebrated. And that first time when you're in love and the other person loves you too, you feel wonderful. You feel potent. Because you are loved, you feel you can talk about yourself and be listened to. And you listen to in a way that you never listen to your parents or your friends. And it's the preciousness of that experience that makes the dream of love so important. It's not just a trivial thing, and it's not just about the sensation of sex. It's about feeling that you are your whole, full self.
Your character thinks sometimes about what it means to, at her age, be not married and to not have children. I'm wondering how it feels to you to be not married and to not have children compared to how you thought it would feel when you were a young woman.
Well, I have never been bothered about married, being married or not married. I can't get over the way in America everybody seems to get married young. I think it's a very odd thing to do. I was often asked, and even one week I had the engagement ring. We were to get married on the Saturday and we decided on the Thursday not to get married. And we went on our honeymoon anyway, but we didn't go to the wedding. And sometimes I bump into people all these years later who say, "Where were you on your wedding day? We were there. Where were you?" But I don't care that I've never been married and that I'm sure I'll never marry. But about being childless, quite apart from how much I love the sight and sound and being of children, and I do. I think that you have to ask yourself, what were you for, in a different way from most people. Most people solve the problem of their own meaning by having children, because then they have now invented a meaning for themselves. Their meaning now, having created children or helped to create children, is to rear those children with as much goodness and intelligence as they can, and to love them always and be loved by them. And so they slide through life belonging to life. And the times of life are appropriate when they're young. The hormones drive them and they make the children in their prime. They protect the children. And then when they're older, they become grandparents and give what they have to the grandchildren. And if you're childless, you're outside that beautiful movement of the generations. And it seems to me that you're far more self-conscious if you're childless. It seems to me that you have to, a woman certainly has to ask herself, well, what was it all about, all the fallings in love and the being mad about people and the choosing my clothes and having periods for 35 years? You know, what was it all for?
Do you feel like you've had to consciously go about constructing a meaning in your life?
I do, and I think that's what I did, quite not knowing that that's what I was doing. When I wrote my memoir, which, of course, never was a memoir. Nobody ever asked for it, and nobody knew I was doing it. It was only an introduction to a book of old opinion columns. But I was in my early 50s, and I couldn't understand why my life had come to so little, and how I'd managed to end up with no partner, no gang of friends, no lover, no children, no money, no particular future to look forward to. And a desire to sort of write in some way to myself about what, looking back, had been the passion that brought me to this. I think I wouldn't have had to do it if I were a mother and a grandmother.
I think I should probably not ask you what meaning you were able to find in your life, because that would be asking you to reduce your life to a little statement here.
It doesn't work like that. You don't find a meaning. You don't at all find a meaning. I still know nothing. And I'm still, fundamentally as solitary as I was then. Mm-hmm. The difference is that I have had a small effect on other people. I know, because I got thousands and thousands of letters about the memoir from other members of the human race about their experience of being human. And I know that in some extraordinary way that managed to leap across culture and gender and age. The way I spoke to myself in desperation at my kitchen table in Dublin, Ireland, when I was 54, that somehow was heard.
Now, your mother had 9 children, and she actually had 13 pregnancies. What impressions did it give you of motherhood, watching your mother raising 9 children?
As best she could, she didn't raise them. She very much resented being stuck in the country in a house with no hot water, with a husband who was gallivanting around in town with all these children. It wasn't an occupation that gave her pleasure. And, you know, I think there's a lot more women than my mother who really get stuck with motherhood when it's not suitable to them. She would have been a great librarian. She would have been a wonderful wife and consort to him if children and poverty hadn't dragged her down.
You are the second oldest of the 9 children. So when you were growing up, was your mother pregnant most of the time?
She was, yeah. And
what did it make you think of pregnancy, watching her be pregnant?
It never made me think anything. Everybody, all the women around were always pregnant. Everyone was pregnant all the time. I know that women seemed to me to be, well, they were effectively a second rate, a race of second rate people in the Ireland I grew up in. There, not only was there no contraception available, unless there was the rhythm method that my mother and the other women in the country had never heard of, and which they could never have enforced on their men anyway. But not only was there no family planning when I was an adult woman, but you weren't even allowed to know that it existed. So when I was an adult woman, and all my sisters along with me, there were men in the Irish Customs Force pulling out the back pages of American and British magazines so that Irish women wouldn't have access to little ads about clinics where you could send away for books. We were supposed not even to know. And that was the condition that Irish women were pushed to by the combination of the native patriarchy and the Roman Catholic Church.
How did you discover birth control?
Well, we heard of it. We heard of it. And, of course, in the 60s, from America, where in my life all good things have come from for us in Ireland. Well, no, but half of the good things, the pill was rumoured to exist.
If you don't mind my asking, were you able to discover birth control the same time you discovered sex?
No, I took the most hideous risks. I have, in fact, never used any birth control, but it became evident to me in my 20s that I must be infertile. And I think I was. I did get pregnant when I was 39, but I had a miscarriage.
Oh. Were you sorry?
I was too confused to know what I felt.
You were sent to, I think, a convent boarding school when you were about 14. And you say,
yes.
Puberty got you into a lot of trouble and that you were stunned by the demands of the body that you had barely noticed before. What kind of things got you into trouble?
Dancing. There used to be dances in the little town we lived in. They started at 10 at night and went on till 4 in the morning. I need hardly tell you that I was a schoolgirl at the convent, a day school. And it was utterly unheard of for schoolgirls to go to these dances. These dances were essentially for the working class to find each other. But I went. I used to steal the money from my poor mother to go. And I'd be locked in and I'd find some other way to get out, and I'd be locked in again and I'd find some other way, and so on and so on. And one Friday, the nuns in the convent managed to track down my father and said to him, we want you to take her away. And it was a real crisis. Now, there were crises occurred all the time in our family, and other people's crises went unmanaged. But for some reason, they went to great trouble for me. By their standards, they went to great trouble for me. My father had a small car and he sold it and bought me the clothes to go to boarding school, because you had to have a trunk, you know. You had to have things like three night dresses and two pairs of shoes and so on. And we'd always only ever had one of anything at the most, you know, one of anything. So I was sent off to a boarding school, an Irish-speaking boarding school up on the border with Northern Ireland. I arrived there the day I was 14 and I didn't get out till I was 17 and a half. And I didn't fit in very well. But it was, like many of those old-fashioned Irish boarding schools, a very, very good education.
Did you like having the structured environment of the convent, or was it just too repressive for you?
I just wanted to get back to dances. I wanted to, I don't know the American for courting, snugging, whatever. That's what I wanted. I wanted to work in a shop like my friends in Dublin, and I wanted to go to dances, and I wanted to be left home by good-looking boys. And I was lost in that stuff. And by accident, on the side, I was very good at school. And by accident, you know, I got scholarships and so on, and firsts in Ireland and everything. But I didn't care about that. I wanted the security of physical love.
Now, your father was a society columnist. What kind of stories did he cover?
Well, the car would call for him at 3 in the afternoon, a limo with the driver, with the cap, and my father would emerge spotless in his evening dress. He was a most impeccable and fastidious little man, and, you know, the house would be in uproar, maybe, and Mammy might have been drinking at lunchtime and we might be looking for money or something. But Daddy went to work. He might go to the launch of some product. He might go to the opening of a ballet season. He might go to a party for a political retiree. Whatever constituted the growing sort of PR world of Dublin, he was the first ever. And then at midnight, he went to his office and he wrote 2,000 words every single night. And the thing came out the next day. And sometimes there'd be something that moved him much more deeply, and then he mightn't go and do his stuff. He would just write a column. I remember when President Kennedy was shot, he wrote a marvellously sincere and affecting column. So I think he was probably a lovely writer who was very much underappreciated from that point of view.
Now, how could it be that you and your sisters and brothers hardly had any clothes, and your father had this fantastic evening wear that he'd go off in every night? I mean, how is it that
he was living in the society world
and you and your family had nothing?
Oh, well, we didn't have nothing. We had just enough. The thing is, he was keeping the show going. I think he must have thought in his own mind that there was nothing he could do by joining us in our chaos. You know, he would have had to be a saint to both do his job and care for us. He was an old-fashioned man of old-fashioned people. It was Mammy's job to look after us. It was his job to bring home the money. And he did bring home the money, but he had to spend a good bit of that money on himself, because he couldn't go about his job in shabby clothes or anything. But, I mean, I have to stress that he loved us, and we loved him.
Now, you've said that depression runs in your family, and you mentioned before that several members of your family have serious trouble. One of your brothers committed suicide. Was there not quite a word for depression in your parents' day?
No, and I don't think there were any antidepressants. It's not depression anyway. It's despair.
Mm. What's the difference to you?
Well, there's something dramatically suffering in those of my brothers and sisters who are suffering. It's not a dull thing they live with. It's a thing that keeps attacking them and trying to drag them down. And it took me a long time to defeat the demons who were trying to drag me down. And I really only did it in middle age. And I wish I'd managed to do it when I was younger so that I wouldn't have wasted my whole 30s in drinking and so on.
Did you drink a lot in your 30s?
Yes. I was an alcoholic, by the end of my 30s. And there, the year I was 40, I was in a psychiatric hospital for a while. But then, luckily, I was completely derelict, really, mentally and emotionally. Luckily, I fell in love with a gay woman. And this was after a lifetime of being mad about various men. And we lived together for 14 years. And it was immensely healing to live with a woman.
In what ways was that healing?
We had a home. I don't know how to explain to you, but I had a domestic life for the first time ever. I loved it. I loved buying cups and buying an egg lifter, and I just loved it. There's an intrinsic tension, I think, between men and women, and it wasn't there between myself and my friend. It's true that the relationship didn't last, but I've had such great strokes of luck in my life, like being sent off to boarding school, and like that one, that she cared about me and stuck with me while I finally sort of kicked sleeping tablets and then cut back and back and back on the drink. If anything, then I became happier and healthier than she. And anyway, we broke up, and a year after I wrote the memoir.
Were you surprised falling in love with a woman?
I was. I was when I came to think of it. But when it actually happened, my whole world was so disoriented because my father had died slowly and very, very savagely. And I'd been drinking and I hadn't slept for 6 months or something, and I could barely hang on to my job. And I don't think I was at all well mentally. So I was free. I was free of every constraint. I didn't know. It never really dawned on me that she was a woman for a while, you know. I mean, of course, I know she was a woman, but the strangeness of it didn't strike me for a long time.
Let me ask you, since I know one of the things you're thinking about is, you know, the process of getting older.
Mm-hmm.
It's I think, always been assumed that you get older, you have children who help take care of you, you have a spouse, if they're still living, who helps take care of you. But a lot of people now aren't married, they're not in a long-term relationship, they don't have children, they're not going to have children, and they're going to be getting older. So the kind of system of how you get by when you get older is going to have to change, because the whole nature of family life for a lot of people has changed.
Yes.
Do you think about that a lot?
I do. I do indeed. And my only motivation for wanting to earn money is for the nursing home at the end. But, of course, you don't know how long you might be infirm. But besides money, what you need, and perhaps this would get you through even if you didn't have any money, you need an attitude to aging that allows you not to regret and not to repine, but to take vitality from the small things of the everyday. And I'm getting better and better at that stuff. First of all, as I say, I discovered animals, small little animals, you know, the company of them. I think food and a moderate amount of drink are great resources as you get older. I think that landscape matters an awful lot. Music means a great deal to me. And it does really. It's not a show-offy thing. It's from my heart for myself. And travel does. And I have a few friends. A lot of them made just recently. So I'm saying that there are lots of things you can put in a palisade around you and plant like little seeds in your heart to sprout in your 60s and 70s and, please God, 80s. When really you can't be hanging around looking for just passion, to go back to the thing we began with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Nuala Ofwelan recorded in 2001. She died Friday of lung cancer at the age of 68. She survived by her partner, John Lo Beer, an American lawyer. They'd been together for about 6 years, and she had been dividing her time between New York and Ireland. I'm Terry Gross.